Is it an alarm? Is it a fire alarm?
No, it's a boat. I'm abstaining, so I'm not going.
Oh, okay.
It'll stop.
So you got 1 minute for time.
Very quickly.
Should have 4 or 5 minutes.
Okay. And very quickly, so for those listening on the podcast, welcome back.
Everyone, and welcome to the EdTech podcast from a foggy London. First up, the usual announcements. Thanks to the 23 people already signed up to the EdTech podcast pop-up drinks out at Web Summit, including guys from Education First, QS Uni Solution, Full Fabric, School Apply, Blipper and Codio. If you know people attending Web Summit who would like the chance to congregate for some EdTech drinks, please feel free to share the Eventbrite link searching for the EdTech podcast pop-up. Next up, if you're in the UK and looking for an interesting new role, the guys at Tech City are looking for a digital skills content manager based in London and aimed at supporting digital startups and closing the digital skills gap. If this sounds of interest, check out the show notes for a further link. Staying in London, Hackney Learning Trust are also keen to work with EdTech innovators looking to pilot their work across schools or offer free coding classes. If you're interested, please email me at theedtechpodcast@gmail.com. After 6 months, I've finally got myself organised with a forward calendar of podcasts. So wherever you are in the world, if you're interested in finding out what themes are coming up, placing adverts or running a takeover, do let me know. We now have content into January 2017 and will soon be announcing the EdTech podcast at ASU GSV in Salt Lake City in May 2017, as well as Reimagine Edu 2017 as they launch their international events. You can keep up to date with all of these bits of news by subscribing to the podcast and the weekly newsletter and keeping an eye on at Podcast EdTech on Twitter and the Facebook page. Now moving on to this week's podcast, a fascinating debate on the efficacy of EdTech, sparked by the then UK Secretary of Education Nicky Morgan's comments at BET 2016 that EdTech will be supported wholeheartedly by government where the evidence is to support. This recording features Danny Kinahan, MP and Chair of the All-Party Parliamentary Group for Education, moderating with Professor Rose Luckin from UCL Knowledge Lab, Brigitte Rico-Bellan, Managing Director of Digital at TES Global, Andy Moss, Head of UK for Higher Education at Pearson Group, and Mike Mompey, Director of Early Stage Investment at Clearly So. Also joining is Caroline Wright, Director General from BISA, who also brought the panel together. There are many questions from executives, including Easy Peasy, Discovery, Department for International Trade, and the Corsham Institute. And this was genuinely one of the best panel discussions I've seen for a long time, with a diversity of opinion, approach, and passion relevant for EdTech companies and educator leaders and practitioners alike. Listen out for the voting bell at the start of the recording and see which version of efficacy you agree with. See you next time.
Good afternoon or good evening, everyone. I'm Danny Kinahan. I'm a student from South Antrim. Any friends of mine 4 or 5 years ago would have thought, Danny, an education? But I had 3 years in the Northern Ireland Assembly as Deputy Chair of Education there, and now chair the All-Party Group here, and with the help of BISA and others, my whole aim is to try and get the All-Party Group to help formulate policy, pull matters together for the ministers and others, and therefore I thoroughly enjoy it. But being Northern Irish, despite this voice, we're all thinking he doesn't sound Northern Irish. I was schooled over here. I sent to a Scottish prep school and then an English public school, then had to learn the Northern Irish system to do my previous role. So I'm in a nice position of not being biased in anything, so I just want to see things being better for everybody. When it comes to technology and learning, for me it was the ball duster being thrown at me. That was the closest I got to technology. I could wake up Kinahan when I was at the back, but then going with my children to see schools and suddenly seeing how much the technology had changed, and whether it was whiteboards or the use of DVDs, and nowadays in all the different ways they're coming, I'm fascinated to see what's going to be said and put forward today. And I have one company in Northern Ireland who I've been talking to, who also have been pushing matters. So I'm very, very keen to find out what's being said today and to get your questions. Now, they all were asked to speak for 5 minutes. I'm afraid this morning when I looked at an hour and I thought, if I give them all 5 minutes, you'll only get, if you're lucky, 30 minutes. So I've asked them to try and speak for 3. But can we all the way through try and keep questions short and sharp? When they've finished speaking, then I'll take groups of 2 or 3 questions at a time and then ask you to answer them, and then we'll try and gather everything together. But thank you very much. But please sort of respect everyone, respect the order that we call people to speak. And I look forward to hearing. And if we could start with yourself,
thank you.
Please.
So I'm Caroline Wright. I'm Director General of BISA. What I'd really like to do with my 3 minutes is just put a little bit of context on the EdTech efficacy into the broader efficacy debate. Because I think we see with government, they're very, very keen, quite rightly, that evidence is used in schools, in decision-making in schools, in using the right products. In schools, teachers have increasingly limited budgets. They want to make the right decision, the biggest bang for their buck, so they're very keen to know about impact. In terms of industry, obviously, members of BISA and companies want to make sure that they stand out from the crowd. So they want to be able to use impact and knowledge to say, actually, my product really does deliver results. But the issue we have at the moment is we've got an increasingly competitive global market, but the way research is being carried out, it's not apples and apples. It can be very much apples and pears. So we're looking at kind of research reports that look at efficacy, but they're not necessarily carried out in the same way for large-scale research in schools. And you have things like governments pledging $41 million for maths textbooks because textbooks are better than digital. And actually, have we ever carried out a large-scale research programme that really looks at, in the same way at those products? And I think that's the biggest challenge, that companies are looking at it in different ways. They need the guidance on what high-quality, proper research should be. Mm. There's also the challenge that we're talking about children's educations. So I can understand why you've never had a school where half of the kids are given some kind of placebo education and the other half in the same environment are given some wonder drug, new education technology. It's our kids. We're very cautious, and I think that's why progress has been slower than it's been in other areas. So for me, speaking on behalf of my members, what I think today is guidance from the experts about companies that have done it really well, what does it look like, so that we can go out and actually, whether you're the smallest company or the larger companies that are doing it already really well, actually what can they do so we're all talking the same language. And just as an example, I asked members before I came here, I said, have you got some really good examples that I could, you know, talk about? And we had some fantastic examples of companies that are probably going to speak later who are here, you know, Renaissance Learning, Essex Education Services and so on. They're doing it already. Then we have companies, actually, it's a struggle. They think marketing is kind of efficacy. So it's actually what tools can we give them to really understand how we move forward? Another final point from me, we're not alone. I was at the OECD Ministerial Summit in Israel 3 weeks ago, and every single country had the same challenges. So I think if we crack it, we can probably export it, which we
can do. Excellent, and I hope we also then get it out to the devolved parliaments as well. Rosie, would you like to lead off? Say who you
are. Yeah, that's fine. So I'm Rose Luckin. I work at something called the UCL Knowledge Lab, so that's University College London. And I've been looking at how we evaluate the efficacy of educational technology for several decades now, and indeed I'm involved in developing educational technology, particularly technology that uses artificial intelligence techniques. So the question that we were posed by Nikki Morgan was, where technology is evidence-based and outcome-driven, where it really works, we will back it all the way. What does she mean? So I can say, I can give you hand on heart, I can show you the evidence that well-designed online communities support teacher continual professional development, if the context is right. By which I mean, if they are given time and if they are supported by their managers to do this. I can show you good evidence, lots of different sorts of evidence, that will show you that well-designed simulation software helps children learn science processes, such as photosynthesis, if the context is right. For example, they have the right prerequisite knowledge to be able to understand the processes and various other things as well. Is that what Nicky Morgan means? I realise she's not Education Secretary anymore, but that was the statement we were given. And the thing is, I suspect that's very like the good examples that you were given, and I suspect the answer is no. Because I suspect, though I may be delightfully wrong, I often am, actually what they're after is something much more generic. Because what I can't tell you is that any online community will work for teachers in continuing professional development. And I cannot tell you that any piece of simulation software will help any child learn a scientific process, because there are way too many variables, most of them around context. And that makes the job really hard. But I don't want to be negative, because the point is, we live in this world. We have to demonstrate efficacy in some way. But perhaps what we could do is start trying for more specific questions. Because what we really need to know is, who? Who do you want us to demonstrate this with? Mm. Is there a particular age group? Is it children on free school meals? Mm. Is it teachers? Who is it? Who is it that you really want? What's the real educational problem you want us to demonstrate? And we'll show you, way better than we can with textbooks. We will be able to show you, but we have to have that specific information in order to be able to demonstrate efficacy in any rigorous way. Then I think we can show something that counts, but we cannot do it generically. And that is my 3 minutes. So I am
well done.
Very, very impressed if you can all do it that way. That's
really good. Andy. So good evening. My name is Andy Moss. I'm the Senior Vice President of Pearson's Higher Education Business in the UK. Great to be here this evening. I will try and stick to my 3 minutes. I can't promise I will. Yes, please do. So I work for Pearson, and as a company, we care deeply about this topic, efficacy and ed tech. We are the world's largest education company, and our mission is to help learners make measurable progress in their lives through learning. And to me, those two words, measurable and progress, are kind of core to any discussion about efficacy. If we can't demonstrate efficacy, then we're failing in our mission, frankly. So we care very much about this concept of efficacy. We also care deeply about technology, the second part of tonight's discussion. So we are investing very heavily in technology as an organisation. We spend around $1 billion each year in product development, product research. And you won't be surprised to hear me say that EdTech is a big area of focus for us as we do that. But we are very, very clear that technology is not a panacea. And technology is not the only way to drive outcomes. To echo what Rosie said, actually, great teaching and great learning starts with great teachers and great pedagogy. And that's something we're very focused on. But we do think if you get technology right, and if you do keep that focus on learner outcomes, then technology can be a great enabler. And it can really help to scale, expand access to great teaching and great learning, and really help to enrich the education process. And we say that because we do have some evidence, tonight's other topic, evidence. So we did a test on our Bug Club product, which is a primary school product here in the UK and around the world. And we did quite a formal test, a randomised control test on 1,500 pupils in a class across 36 schools. And we, not quite a placebo effect, but we did look at kids using our Bug Club product. And the results were quite astounding, actually, really highly statistically relevant improvements in learner outcomes from using our product. So that's an example that we can give that does talk to evidence in ed tech. But that's not good enough for us, actually. That's just one example. And what we want to look at is how we systematize this and how do we create a framework that allows us to demonstrate for every product and service that we do that we can deliver improved learning outcomes. And if we can't demonstrate that, and if we can't see a way through it, how do we exit from that product or that service? Because it's not core to our business if it can't deliver that. So we've actually made a commitment, big gulp. By 2018, we will report publicly alongside our audited financials. We will report audited efficacy data for our products and services. And this will be independently verified. So as you can imagine, there's a lot of work happening to make that real. And to help deliver that, we developed what's called the efficacy framework, what we call the efficacy framework. And it was developed by an amazing guy, Sir Michael Barber, our chief education advisor, about 5 years ago. And at its heart, it looks at four elements to try and systematize efficacy. So the first is clarity around the learning outcomes that you're trying to achieve. So are we clear what we actually want to achieve for the learner? Sounds so obvious, and if you don't do that, it's a bit like getting in a car and setting off without actually knowing where you're trying to get to. So being really clear from the outset, what are the outcomes you're trying to achieve? And we do that in different ways. We run efficacy workshops or outcomes workshops. We run kind of control groups and run various kind of models to look at different forms of outcomes and how they apply to products and services. The second element, once we've done that, is to attach metrics so that we can measure how we're doing and we can actually track progress and see that we are making progress against those outcomes. The third element sounds really boring, but it's all about planning then, implementation. So implementing with fidelity and making sure we actually do and we set this up, the product or the service, in the right way to deliver those outcomes and deliver the data to measure it. And then the last and my last point really is the critical piece is around capacity to deliver. And this is so important when we talk about technology in particular. So making sure that we do focus on change management alongside the product or the service. Because we see it time and again, teachers are teaching kids who were born digital and they weren't, and they're afraid, as I am with my kids. My kids are much better on technology than I am. And so, unfortunately, the technology stays in boxes and it gathers dust. And we've seen this in countries in the UK, around the world. So our job is to equip the teacher, actually, to make sure that the teacher can see how and when and where best to apply technology to enrich that great teaching, that great pedagogy that they're responsible for, that they're delivering. And technology can help them, but we have to help them because there's so many different products with different claims. So helping the teacher to understand and not be afraid of the technology solution that you're offering is crucial. So they're the four elements of the framework. To an earlier point, we are very clear that we haven't got all the answers at all. When we publish the framework, we actually call it the incomplete guide, because we just know that this is such a big topic and we can't solve it on our own. So engaging with all parts of the education ecosystem is crucial to us, because we are a big education company, but we're tiny in the education world in the scheme of education. So it's by engaging and by working and by learning together that we can hopefully achieve our mission, which is to help learners make measurable progress in their lives through learning. So I'll stop now, but thank you. I'm looking forward to it.
So Mike Monty here. I work at an organization called Clearly So. I should probably introduce the organization to provide a little bit of context as to why I'm here. Clearly So is an impact investment bank. So that means we look at this from an investment perspective, and we look at all investments, and we look at the impact of those investments. So it's not just looking at kind of risk and financial return, it's also looking at impact. And one of the key areas where we focus is education. So we look at health, education, environment, and other social issues. So when it comes to education and efficacy, it's critical for us. So I absolutely love how Pearson are starting to publish the efficacy results, the key metrics, along with the financial performances. So that's really one of the key things that we look at. When people talk about EdTech, I think a lot of people assume that it's kind of within the classroom, but there are different types of EdTech, and there's a different level of efficacy that I think one can look to gain clarity on. So for example, it can be operational efficiencies, it can be sharing platforms for teachers and content. So I think if it's maybe an early years intervention directly engaging young people, then maybe an RCT can be more relevant. If it's looking at operational efficiency, so technology kind of for a back end for a school system, you know, the efficacy can be clear. You might be saving a certain number of hours or a certain period of time, enabling teachers to kind of spend more face time with the students. So I think there are different ways to think about efficacy and the different types of education technology. And again, a lot of the key points have come out already, but when we talk about ed tech, again, tech is not a solution. Tech is a tool that helps better hone, better target the solutions that we know are clinically efficacious and have been validated.
So the perspective or the point I'll be taking is one bit more from the investment community, where we, you know, we've had the pleasure of working with a lot of companies who have RCTs and who have clinically validated data, as well as with companies who just say they're highly impactful and are changing lives without that data. So we see about 2,000 companies a year that are doing amazing things or claim to be doing amazing things and actually trying to identify which one is more efficacious than the other and what is the ultimate impact is a key area of our focus. So I'm happy to kind of provide that.
Okay, so I'm Brigitte Ricoubelon. I'm from TES. I'm managing director of TES Digital. So in our world at TES, as I'm sure many know, it's all about recruiting excellent teachers. It's about training teachers and helping teachers create lessons and deliver lessons. And I'll talk more specifically about our marketplace platform, which is really big at tech investment, which has been going on for quite a few years. So, you know, we think at TES, and it's clearly our focus in many ways, that's a great way to focus on efficacy and student outcome is to start with the teacher and really empower teachers to deliver those outcomes. And there are three ways where over time we've really, I think, built some really, really good evidence of impact, efficacy around teachers. The first one is really working with independent third parties. We've done since about 3 or 4 years, a lot of research with Stanford universities. In fact, three professors were really fascinated by the size of our marketplace, and that really helped us highlight some of the kind of key metrics around our marketplace. So we did a number of surveys, they did a lot of data exploration. High level, what we found is that teachers not only really value the content, they find it relevant, and we have lots of really good metrics on that. It's on our site if you want to see that a bit more specifically. They find the content of high quality, but really more importantly, and we wanted to verify that, they use the content in the classroom. And that's about 75% of teachers downloading content. You know, that was a question. We have huge amount of content being downloaded, 200 million, I was sharing this data since the beginning of the year. Is that content actually used? And yes, you know, it is. The other thing we found, which I think is really interesting, is that teachers really value being part of that community, and they gave us really high mark on the fact that they feel using this community makes them better teachers. And that's something we validated through the Stanford research, but also more recently through a piece of research we did with Mozilla. Actually, the results will be presented in a couple of weeks. And 75% of teachers told us that they were better teachers through essentially using the community and peer-to-peer learning, which, again, you know, I think is really interesting and shows the value for the teacher community of feeling part of this really big marketplace. So we have roughly 8 million numbers, so it's a very big number. I think the other domain around evidence and efficacy is really what I would call social proof, and it's really derived on data and some of what I would call the intense engagement we have on our platform. So I've shared a few numbers, but I always like sharing this story of this wonderful author we had on our platform. She passed away recently. Her name is Bev Evans. She was a special needs teacher. Her resources, she has about, I think, 100, 150 resources, have been, as we speak, I checked the number this morning, downloaded 5.2 million times. And used over 200 countries. I think the number speaks by themselves. And if you add to that a very, very substantial number of reviews we get on the platform, that's also something which, you know, for us has a lot of value. And lastly, and you know, I think it's slightly more intangible evidence in a way of efficacy, but it's really about what we call at TES making the space to teach. We believe that by giving more time to teachers, and you know, I think there are lots of research around how much time teachers spend planning lessons, and recently the I think independent workload group established about 9 hours. There are some OCD studies which shows about 7 hours, but you know, it's a substantial amount of time. So we believe if you are able to give back some of that time to teachers and essentially enable them to do other things, and very often we believe it will be being about being better teachers and spending probably more time actually teaching, more time in the classroom. That's also something which is really helpful. So our, you know, I would say our evidence studies story is really all about empowering teachers and helping, you know, better outcomes at that level. And again, lots of evidence, tangible, I think, and intangible. And, you know, it's a hard, I think, topic in many ways, and it's about constant learning and sharing and learning from each other. So it's still work in progress in many ways.
Thank you. Very much. I now over to you with your questions. I mean, I'd love to hear some examples when you're answering as well, although I assume everyone in the room knows what we're talking about. But I see most of it seems to revolve around helping teachers
but on the other side, of course, are the parents and the pupils themselves. But it's now over to you. So who would like to start me off with questions?
The first question was from Becky Sage from Interactive Scientific, which asked, how do you start to test efficacy before your product is fully developed?
I can certainly start on that. Okay, three things. First, you can look at existing evidence about how immersive environments work well, and I'm guessing you've already done that, but that's your starting point. So you start with that. Second, you make a decision about what it is will demonstrate success for you. Now, we talked a lot about learning outcomes, and personally, I don't think they're the things that you should be looking at in an ideal world. We're not in an ideal world, and that's what counts here at the moment. You have to look at them. But you need to demonstrate what it is that's special about your product that means that you get those learning outcomes. I would not suggest a randomized control trial. Because that will only tell you a very generic, for an average, you know, everything being equal, which it isn't, you know, it works statistically significantly or not. It won't really tell you what is special about what you're doing, your unique selling point of your product or service that means that you get that learning outcome. So, and you need that if you're going to improve your product. So it's not just about, yes, it improves the outcome, it's about how it does that, which means you need to look at tracking. And my third point, very, very shortly, is that we are due to start a project at the Knowledge Lab precisely to help people like you, to give people advice about how you design a good pilot study and a good evaluation. So they're my three practical tips.
Well, to echo what Rose said, actually, but I'd say, I mean, that's a problem we've been trying to solve for as well, actually, because we are building efficacy into every product, whether it's an existing product or, you know, from ideation through to kind of launch, effectively. I'm biased, but I would say the framework, and we apply different levels of data, actually, and data kind of standards, as Rose says. I wouldn't recommend RCTs, for example. And as we go through the kind of early stage from ideation to kind of MVP, minimum viable product, we're looking at, you know, are we absolutely clear, to Rose's point, are we clear what we mean by learner outcomes? I think that's crucial, actually, because actually, what are you trying to solve for? And are you crystal clear? And then actually, we look at, can you attach metrics to that? So we're not trying to collect the data at that point. We're just trying to make sure we've got measurable outcomes that have been defined and built into the product set that we can then start to collect the data around. And then the quality of evidence does depend, actually, on the sort of product or service. But I would totally agree. I mean, I think it needs to flex based on your circumstance. The other thing I would offer is, again, there's quite a lot of material on our website. We've published everything we're doing on this openly because we're trying to, as I say, learn. I'll happily take your details and send some links, but you'll probably find quite a lot on our website around how we've gone about building this into product development, early stage, all the way through to mass market products. So that might be helpful.
Maybe just to add briefly to that, without repeating any of the points that were previously mentioned, I think one key variable and element that can often be overlooked, kind of pre-commercial or pre-market, is uptake and usage. So something can be academically validated as effective. There can be RCTs, whether or not, you know, you're considering the kind of ethical issues there, whether or not you think that's the right approach. But if people don't use it, then it can be as effective as you'd like. But in reality, it's not effective, and it's quite ineffective. So I think one thing that you can get ahead of the outcomes, if it's kind of based on academic evidence, but prior to kind of commercializing, is what's the usage? So what's traction? What's usage? Are people using it? It depends if it's optional or if it's baked into the curriculum. But that's a key element that I think is often overlooked, and it's a bit maybe too commercial or too straightforward. But it's certainly one to consider for anyone who is launching a business or looking to have an impact.
The next question was from G. Lee, Managing Director at Plum Innovations Limited, who supports schools with IT technicians. He asked, given his technicians are on the front line of integrating EdTech products in schools and receiving all the feedback, how could they support vendors on their efficacy development better?
I'm not a vendor, so... Oh, God.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. So I'll just make maybe two points. I mean, I think I totally agree with you. I think I used the word earlier, education ecosystem. We're very clear that, again, Pearson is trying to ensure that all of our products can plug and play effectively, so through APIs, etc., that we're kind of platform agnostic, if you like. So we want to work with different platform providers, different vendors, because we can't solve for everything. And I think it's actually by harnessing all the data that comes through the system that you do start to collect some really interesting data around efficacy, both in terms of usage and who's actually using the product, but also importantly how you can improve and how you can start to build that into that kind of feedback loop. So as I think about, and sorry, final point, as I think about in my world now, higher education and the teaching excellence framework and how we're actually going to measure teaching excellence across universities that have disparate systems, it's through working with various elements, whether it's the software support and the infrastructure providers, whether it's through the education resource providers like ourselves, lots of different data points that will all feed into understanding what it really means for a student to succeed and to set that student up for success. So I think you're a crucial part of the system, and if we can't work with all parts of the system, then we won't answer the question, frankly.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, just to build on that, obviously relationships with individual companies and suppliers and yourself, that's for individual products. But I think, and I would say this, wouldn't I, and G's a very active member of our software and technology special interest group within BISA, but I think kind of industry forums or groups where companies can come together and talk, taking away the specifics of an individual item, there's probably four or five key themes that you deal with day in, day out that actually could be dealt with as a group and shared, and then actively all companies can learn from that as well to sort of build on where we're going from. So I think that's actually a great topic we should look at one of our next meetings.
And definitely it's an invaluable job. I would just like to say that. I might not be a vendor, and I'm do an invaluable job.
I think coming at that from a fairly different perspective, but maybe there are also some simple metrics which are unifying metrics, and that might not be relevant in your world, which I don't know in great deal of details, but things like simple survey, simple NPS, just satisfaction, just making sure your services are used, are useful, are, I like to say that as well, delightful. I think those things that help to benchmark, and sometimes just having a few standards which might be really, really simple and might help create this kind of framework of feedback.
Just to give an example of a company, some of you might have come across EduKit. So they're effectively trying to kind of aggregate the, given how exciting this market is, right, so many people do want to do something with technology and education because they see the potential. They're trying to aggregate a lot of these different interventions or these programs or these solutions, but also integrate into the existing kind of school IT systems to track data, track efficacy, and look at more longitudinal kind of impact and isolate the variety of variables on the individual's interaction. So if there's any way you can link up with EduKit, EDUKIT, or have a conversation with them, it's probably useful because it sounds like there's a really interesting opportunity there.
Thank you.
Next up, Jen Lexman from Easy Peasy, an app for school readiness with support from partners including the Design Council and Oxford University. Her question was to BISA, what forums and audience were available for home learning and for parents given the proliferation of EdTech products and support networks around K-12? What was out there for early intervention products and services?
Yeah, no, that's really, really interesting. And actually we had conversations with successive education ministers on that topic because we engage with them on industry's behalf, but actually, and the challenge is rightly of kind of what a company is doing to improve the quality of products and outcomes, but actually there's a role as well as schools and teachers of what parents do. And we have been working with members a lot in terms of your own websites and your own offerings, of making sure that there are sort of parents' pages and information on your own products that parents can then, active parents can get engaged in easy to understand language rather than the whole jargon of education, which when you first become a parent just hits you in the face and you've got no idea what you need to be doing. So actually making it sort of common sense guide for parents, but then going to where parents congregate. So actually, where are the kind of the online forums that they're talking about? And you know, you will see that the strands going through. My child is on this book, you know, level. Is this normal? Kind of all of these kinds of conversations. What are you trying to do? There will be a whole, you know, range of websites dedicated to parents talking about those kinds of issues. So going where the parents are. There are also kind of talk afterwards, but there are exhibitions and conferences where there are kind of home educators are targeted, and you can talk to them there. But again, I think it's shaping it in a language that will be appropriate for parents to be able to understand.
Can I just pick up on something there? Because I have seen you present Easy Peasy, and I think it's very nice. Early years, absolutely fundamental, can make all the difference in the world. Parents, we know, their home background is a big influencer on educational outcomes. Self-regulated learning, readiness, you're not looking at learning outcomes. Great. Because self-regulated abilities mean better learning. Good self-regulation is a key skill to learning. And actually, for me, that's far more valuable than being able to show me that at a particular point in time, so-and-so scored more on their maths test, and they do use this product. So I think that's great. You've also had independent evaluation of your product, which I think is a really good idea as well, because that gives a bit of blue water. And I think that's all great, and I would like to see more of that. The problem is, of course, we do have to demonstrate learning outcomes to politicians. I'm not saying you should do anything different. We could do that. You've got a framework. I've got huge respect for Michael Barber. I'm sure it's a really good framework. You know, we can demonstrate that a particular tool, if it's good, will lead to improved learning outcomes. And that's what the politicians want to hear. But we can't do it generically. And that's what worries me, is that I'm sure all the people at BISA, you ask them for evidence. I know, you know, for specific pieces of software in specific situations, we can demonstrate that, but somehow that's still not enough. I actually think what you're doing in the long term will be more important, because we will start to look beyond learning outcomes, and that's when those skills, those metacognitive skills, will be recognised as being far more important, because they'll be more important in the workplace, but they're also more important in terms of learning maths, physics, geography, whatever it is.
Yeah, and I wonder if one of the reasons that they're still struggling to be taken as seriously, or why they struggle to be the focus of attention on results and outcomes, is precisely because of this issue of the apparent difficulty of measuring.
Yeah.
And I think there are ways that you can do it.
There are.
And like I said, before we got to the stage that we're at now, we were running our own tiny randomized control trials with, like, you know, 30 parents in a local school. We'd use an online tool to randomize them. You know, we used very short surveys so that we didn't overwhelm the parents.
But that's I think that would be a problem larger scale, because what are you giving the control group?
Well, you use early starters and late starters.
Yeah, so but I just think that I don't think in the end the randomized control trial is the best way of doing it. That's just...
Right.
I don't think you end up with the richness of evidence that you'll need to demonstrate more than a kind of a yes-no. You want to demonstrate exactly what's happened. So, but, you know, they have their place, and I understand that people respect them in the same way that people respect learning outcomes. And so we're kind of stuck in that space at the moment. But the more things like you're doing, I think the better, because that will in the end demonstrate the huge value in the soft skills, as people call them.
On the independent research, and something we've spent quite a lot of time thinking about, what I find really interesting is doing that, you know, once, but then continuing the relationship. And I don't know what is the nature of the relationship with the Department of Education at Oxford University, but being able to do that over time, I think, is also where things become really valuable. And it's also, in some ways, you know, I'm sure you're thinking about that in that way, marketing tool, and which can be really helpful. But my point here, it's not just a one-off, and it's something which is complex, has got kind of multiple layers, develops over time, and the value, the richness will be, in my mind, you know, what you're doing will be to kind of be able to spread that over a few years and come back to, you know, the results, how do they evolve. That's the really interesting piece, and we've seen that, you know, in our Stanford piece. It's been really, you know, the first year was really interesting, but the third year was kind of fascinating, and we started to go really deep. So just sharing a little bit of experience there.
Anyone else want to? I'm quite fascinated with that. I realise from a politician's point of view, do we need is to take something like that on board and get somewhere to do the pilot study and get it fully assessed and worked through, whether that is the council or going through the multi-academy trusts or finding another, but it's something I'll talk to you about to see if we can open the door with the mic, 20 of you in here with good ideas. But we do have to look at things. We in Northern Ireland produced new tests a few years ago. Came in and they didn't pilot them properly. They misfired on the first day, and as politicians we had everybody grumbling because the parents couldn't understand how to help their children, and the children couldn't understand when they actually got their results, different children were coming out top because they were better with the technical skills than the ones from before, and so a whole lot of issues came out of it. We're trying to get better pilot studies done next time. One there and then I'll come to you, sir.
The next question was from Martin Byron, Managing Director at Global Vocational Skills Limited, who first of all recognised the slightly isolated voice of vocation, again with the proliferation of K-12 support around education innovation, but also asked, what do we do to hold people's hands and to encourage change? And where is that optimum point between digital approaches to education and more traditional approaches?
I actually care deeply about the vocational education because I'm a trustee of UFI, and if you were ever looking for funding, I suggest that you might like to look in their direction, by the way. I taught in further education before going into university, and it is a really difficult thing. And what you said to me right at the start, said to us right at the start about learning analytics and marrying in with what Brigitte was saying about longer term, which is part of my problem with the RCT approach, is in that sector, there is exactly what you're describing, a tendency not to see the technology as an enabler. But people come at that with lots of different views. Now, if you have good learning analytics done across data sets collected over time, you can then probe that data to be able to demonstrate more than one thing, and therefore to be able to demonstrate a different range of answers for people who are asking different questions or have different problems with why it's not an enabler. So I would definitely encourage you to go down that route and to think about what the variety of audiences within your vocational sector is, and look at how from the same core data set you can use different learning analytic probes to address those issues and use the data cumulatively, so you're collecting it all the time, so it grows.
So I'm a huge fan of vocational as well, I have to say, because, I'm not even sure what vocational means these days.
Yeah, right.
Blurring between academic and vocation. But, you know, Pearson, for example, we design and award the BTEC qualifications and the higher nationals, which, quote unquote, are vocational qualifications. And maybe just to blend and marry the earlier points as well, what I think is fascinating, really exciting about BTECs is when we talk about learner outcomes rather than learning outcomes, and BTECs really test and are designed to encourage problem solving, collaboration, teamwork, alongside other quite unquote traditional academic kind of disciplines. So I think they do marry and maybe talk to some of the challenges you're facing about what's perceived as skills, actually. But in terms of the point around resistance to change, I agree with Rose. I mean, in some ways, as I said earlier, I think, you know, a lot of the resistance comes from fear, actually, and that's understandable because you know it's either a fear that you don't understand the device, or your students, your learners will understand it better than you do, and therefore you've lost that ability to teach. I think we have to change that model, and I do think blended really helps to flip that model, actually, so that the relationship between the teacher and the student really changes, actually. I saw an amazing video recently from a tutor in the US using some blended learning products, and he was saying, actually, what's happened is my role has now fundamentally changed, and I'm actually learning with the student, and it's become a much richer deeper relationship. So I think blended is a way to start to kind of break down those barriers, but it has to be accompanied by change management. You know, again, back to that point, you know, this is not something that's going to happen on its own if you have that resistance to change. So I think you have to tackle it with that approach and isolate and understand the causes of resistance and then work to support them. So that's how that would be my advice.
Okay. And only added, some people who want to see efficacy, obviously bringing back to this whole debate, being able to prove that it's more efficacious is also going to help move people along.
We've now got three questions coming in, so what I'm going to do this time is get all three questions.
The next question was from Vipul Bhargava from the Department for International Trade, who stated that he feared being asked why the UK would be focusing on edtech when, given our standings in the PISA rankings, those who perhaps did not have such a digital approach to education were doing better, and was our focus on edtech an attempt to fast-track our way up the PISA rankings? What were the panel's opinions on this approach? The next question was from Lewis Bronze MBE, founder and director of content at Discovery Education, who asked, given his 20 years in education technology, do we really believe Nicky Morgan and turned the whole idea of efficacy on its head, pointing back towards government in the sense that when and if efficacy shows that education technology works, will they really back us all the way, and where is the evidence to suggest they will do so? Next up was Richard Mayle, Director of Research and Innovation at Corsham Institute, who asked, are we doing enough to protect the data and privacy of our students?
Gosh, I'm rather regretting having tried to greet three questions like that together. Yeah. So who would like to start me on the end goal? What is the end goal?
Could I start with the data one, actually? Because I think that's a really important one, actually.
Okay, go on the data one.
So to answer your question directly, are we doing enough? I think now, finally, there's enough attention coming on this topic. I think it's a really important one. I work a lot with universities in the UK. I think they are very, very focused now on this issue. And I think we spend a lot of time talking about how we are securing student data. It's not addressing your point about pre-16, but I think there is a real light being shone on this. And I think it's really important, frankly. You know, we are, as a company, consumers of a lot of data. We are very, very careful about how we use that data. And I think we need to hold the whole industry to that standard. And we have to hold ourselves accountable because, you know, this is potentially, well, it could undermine all the efforts if we get this wrong. So I think that focus on data privacy is crucial. I think it's great you phrased it.
I think, if I can just add in that 30 years ago, when Pearson's was selling educational equipment, it would go into the school and be given out to. Whereas now, and I would say that a lot of teachers aren't technology aware, so to speak. use that app because it's free. Yeah. Well, we all know it's not free.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's about what role does there need to be an overarching governing entity that actually has some form of verification on software which actually says, yes, it complies with a set of morals and principles. But it's not just about how the entity manages data, it's about how it's actually going out to this wonderful cloud, but it could be over in AWS. What are they putting around their element of protection?
So I'll just very quickly try and sort of give my views on all three. The PISA question, I think it's really important to, you can't take one measure as well as then you've got the cultural differences. You talked about pupils being in school for 10 hours. You've got the different parental aspirations in different countries. You've got a whole range of factors that I think we need to be really careful about trying to solve, use something to solve. And I'll just use an anecdote. We had an inward mission of Chinese early years investors and buyers coming into BISA last week, and they met with our early years manufacturers and producers. And okay, China, higher up in terms of kind of various PISA rankings, they said to us, we have to, our curriculum means that we have to do the 10 hours and we have to kind of focus on the knowledge-based learning. But actually what we're missing and what we're looking to Britain for is that creativity, the aspects that really build the other side of achievement and rounded personalities. So I think there's a danger in just following one tactic. tack and saying actually something will be the solution to that. So that's kind of my view on PISA. A really good question to really believe Nicky Morgan.
it's linked
being very, very diplomatic. It's Justin Greening now. And what I would say is when I met Justine Greening earlier on in the year when she was still in the Department for International Development post, she was personally really interested in talking about how digital and technology could be used in crisis zones and actually in refugee situations and how that could be impactful. She was very interested. She did grill me on kind of where's the evidence and what can you prove, but she was very open-minded towards ed tech and digital, so that's a positive. In terms of the kind of what have we actually seen the department doing, I was in earlier on in the week meeting with the sort of relatively new head of the technology team in the department, and we should take encouragement from the fact they've gone up from one person to two. Mm-hmm. She had a new starter on Monday with her, and I met him. So, you know, they've got a kind of, you know, they've increased their numbers and they are planning. Some of the, what they were hoping to announce was obviously delayed somewhat by some of the other events of the summer. So they're hoping that, I think, digital strategy and an edtech strategy should be with us shortly. So that's that. On the privacy, I mean, really, really important issue. And for the first time, we carry out ICT research. How do schools use ICT, edtech? We've been doing it for 25 years. Obviously, it's changed massively. We introduce new questions and areas into that research every year. This year, for the first time, we really looked at security, asking teachers and schools what their worries are. And it is obviously one of their top worries. So I think it's an area that's worth looking into in much more detail. As a separate focus for something, ideally.
I'm going to do a quick answer to all three as well, if that's okay. Caroline's given you a brilliant answer on PISA about they don't have the other skills, but in addition, PISA are developing new metrics, collaborative problem solving. We didn't do that in the UK, but they are, and I know from talking to Andreas Schleicher that they're also looking at metacognition, and they will be trying to that. And then I think you'll see quite a different situation. And incidentally, China are investing big time. So it may not be apparent in the and in AI. So to add that, Lewis, absolutely, I can say it because I'm independent. Don't believe a word of it. What I do believe is that every, doesn't matter what political colour they are, every Secretary of State for Education believes they know about education because they went to school, and they think they have the ideal way of doing education, and they will invest in what progresses that. I do not believe they're interested in the evidence. Just look at what Theresa May said yesterday about grammar schools. Not in the least bit interested in real evidence, so she's asking for evidence. It's a very, very particular type of evidence. So that's my take on that. And in a way, I think we just have to keep up the pressure about what really matters about learning, and keep trying to demonstrate that. I don't know what else we can do, but we have to keep doing that, because actually what matters is people get better education. Mm-hmm. And thirdly, Richard, totally disagree with Caroline and Andrew. We are so ignorant on this. And I am scared. And I have an expertise in artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. I gave evidence to the Science and Technology Select Committee inquiry on robotics and AI. And the report came out last week. And when I started talking at one point, one of the members said, oh my goodness, that's so frightening. I said, yes, it is. And we're not doing enough. We have to start looking at this issue because it's going to hit us soon and we are not prepared. When I spoke to Neil Carmichael from the Education Committee in the spring and asked him a question about this, he gave me the answer that the answer was multi-academy trust. It was not on his radar. It is a huge problem. I wish I could be less scaremongery, but actually it really is. And we are trying to press for some work in this area, and the report last week does call for a commission to advise the government. And unfortunately, whilst the report says lots of stuff about education and skills and how important this is for education and skills, it doesn't actually state that we have to have an education and skills expert on that panel, that commission. And I really hope they don't just ignore that, because we have to have this explored, because this is children and students and people, and lots of data is being collected from skimming and harvesting on social media, and there is no privacy. So it's a real problem.
Thank you. Either of you want to come in or have?
Can I give you I think to say a few things on I think the first question, completely agreed on the rich metrics, and then, you know, not being an expert in that domain, what I give you is also the parents' answer in some ways. It's clearly thinking about, in my mind, in terms of kind of student outcome, also the ability to learn and learn to learn. And we've all heard that, but I think it's actually crucially important. And you know, I think looking narrowly at PISA metrics as they are today is a very, very limited view of the world. That's clear to me. And when I think we try to answer the question today, we certainly took a much broader view, specifically, you know, in my mind, around the focus on teachers and giving them useful and valuable tools and empowering them, because they know in many ways, you know, how to adapt, how to kind of create those differentiated learning experiences which really are going to transform the students. So I think that's another maybe angle of thinking about that. I won't go the controversial route other than to say, you know, I think it's kind of same kind of answer. There are many, many ways of thinking about outcomes. And we'd like to think it's not just about assessments and results, even if I understand it's important on many levels, and certainly from a, you know, government perspective. And I think, you know, on the third point, certainly something we take very seriously, and we all really need more work on that. There are some best practices probably, and I might not be an expert on that, but it seems to me the US might be a little bit more advanced. We've looked quite closely because we have a site which is global at you know, COPA, and some of those kind of experiences are helpful, probably not enough. Rose, I take your point, and you know, there are also some things which sound kind of pretty worrying, and we have to tackle. That's really important.
Before handing it back to you, I can add a little bit to this. The question, I think, was thoroughly answered by my colleagues on the panel. I'll start at the back, just on the security point. Fortunately, it's not just in education where there's a threat to data and security. So there are top experts across various verticals and various industries. So from kind of how to talking about security, right? I think that was to wake everyone up.
Yeah.
That was
given the
time. 5 minutes.
Okay. And very quickly, so for those listening on the podcast, welcome back. Commercial break. So very quickly on security. Fortunately, experts across many verticals working in the space. I can mention just very quickly, so Jen from EasyPeasy, we've been very fortunate to work with EasyPeasy, and I think that sort of, that value placed on the different types of developmental kind of stages and learning outcomes is incredibly useful, and in terms of working, I think the changes to those will start to maybe reflect some of those earlier interventions and different approaches. And then another example is an adaptive learning's mathematics platform developed and built here in the UK. There was an attempted acquisition by a big Chinese educational company, but instead they put in a significant investment and rolled it out across a few thousand schools. So the innovation, I think, is picking up in places kind of across the world. Those are just a few interesting.
Okay, thank you. I thought I'd better answer the political one. point of view. I always think everyone forgets that most politicians are amateurs. We all come from different angles to do different things. Yes, you may get one that has a greater interest in education, but that might be the most dangerous thing you get, because they believe they know what they're talking about. So what I lead on to say about the vital thing is to get us to ask the questions and keep firing the questions in so that any of the rest of us in the chamber can ask a question, and if we don't quite get it, then there are lots of different ways of pushing and shoving, and that's the vital thing, but we need you to raise the questions with us so that we ask them. But do always remember that, you know, we don't necessarily know what we're doing. We're learning as we do it. Civil servants are teaching us what we can, and then your lobbying is what really teaches us how to do things. And then, of course, every now and again, you get rid of us all and you have to start again. but that's just the nature. But it's a real thrill being involved as part of it. But we do need you to push us through it. Anyway, who else has got a question? Sir?
The last few questions were from Mark Chambers at NACE, who asked, what is independent research?
Absolutely. Yes, I think... with the best will in the world, when you're running a company, of course you want to demonstrate that your product or service works better. And I think, therefore, you do need to get some kind of independent involvement. So what counts as independent is a really interesting question. I think it has to be that the person who's carrying out the evaluation has no personal gain from that evaluation, other than obviously the cost of their time doing it is being paid, because there has to be some exchange of money, otherwise nothing can happen, but they're not personally gaining anything. And that's where universities can have a good role, because, you know, they have the skills, they have the expertise. But what we're trying to do with this project that I, you know, I hope will be starting very, very soon, is to help particularly ed tech startups, so smaller companies and SMEs, design effective evaluation studies. And we can't carry all of those out as independent experts, but what we can do is try and say, look, we've helped them design it. Now, that's not the same, I appreciate, but hopefully it will give some kind of evidence that the design of the study has been done in an independent way. Because I think it's very hard for people to go out and get independent validation, because part of one thing is that there's the cost of it, you know. So I think, you know, it's very impressive that you've managed to do it with Oxford, and that's great.
We had the support of the Sutton Trust.
There you go.
And then the Fairbairn Foundation.
You know,
but, and
they, that's,
those organisations can, I think, play a huge role.
Yes, absolutely. So I think, you know, that there are different ways of doing it. But yeah, it has to. But there has to be some, as they say, clear blue water, so that it can't possibly seem that there's any kind of benefit. Now, that's difficult, because you could say somebody like myself is biased, because I believe that educational technology can be effective. But I was very careful. The first thing I said was well designed. So I'm only interested in demonstrating something that really does help. And I think that's true for most people in academia, because if we want to publish a paper about something, we are peer reviewed, and we would have to be able to demonstrate and justify to our peers that what we'd been saying wasn't in some way biased. So I think it is possible to have independence, and I think we can also take it one step further for less cost, being realistic, by trying to do some independence in terms of at least helping with the design of studies, perhaps what's being measured, how it's being measured, and how it's being analysed.
Could I just give the private, because obviously Pearson for profit company, you know, we stand kind of open to that accusation, I think, and it's great, Mark, you've raised it, I think, and, you know, so how are we tackling that? Because, you know, there have been people that say it's a cynical marketing ploy, and I think that's understandable, frankly. The way we're tackling it in two ways, truthfully. One is we are getting independent, audited verification of what we say, so it's not us saying it, it's being audited in the same way a company's financials are. To you can debate how independent an audit of the financials is, but, you know, so we're getting third-party validation, if you like, through that. I think the most important thing, though, is how do we as a company act on the data? And if we can be seen, and we've already started to do this, if we step back from products because we can say, if we can show they're not effective, a company that's cynically trying to market would still push that product into the market, frankly. They would manipulate the data. We started to pull back. We sold a business last year because we said, actually, we can't demonstrate how this plays into educational outcomes. So I think watch how companies react and use the data. And if everything's positive, then I think you'd start to suspect something maybe isn't quite right. But so I think two things: independent verification, like Rose says, and different ways you can do that. And then how companies react to the data. So do you start to see them making some tough choices, frankly?
I mean, from a politician's point of view, whenever we're being lobbied by somebody, we have to ask ourselves that question as well.
Yeah, for sure.
And certainly in my constituency, you'll have a company pushing for something. You've then got to check it out and find another specialists think of it, and so it is a question that's always coming through our minds as well. Anyone else want to?
Yeah, I completely agree with this perspective. I just wanted to make the point that having, you know, established all of that, it's still really important in your communication, I think, with users, with potentially customers, being able to share some data is also part of the story. So I think it's kind of a valid point in my mind to be able, once, you know, again, all those boxes have been ticked, to share some of that data. So I think it's really important to make that available, openly, is my point.
Mm. Mm.
Any more questions?
Amanda Duncan at Scribe Easy, who asked the panel their opinion on an alternative method of measuring excellence outside of standardised testing, and perhaps have their view on badges.
I'm a fan, frankly. I think I'm a fan of what badges represent, which is kind of effectively creating that spine of education. I don't think necessarily, I think in levels these days it's crazy, but you know, level 1, 2, 3, 4, do learners really think like that, and do they learn like that, and do they not deserve stepping off points if they don't get to that next significant level that's been deemed as significant? So I think badges have a really important role to play in giving learners transferable credits, and I think they'll become more important the more and more we see quote unquote non-traditional learners, so lifelong learning and learners who are learning in work or with other kind of calls on their time. So I think badges have a really important role to play. But I do think the standards that they're measured against is really important, because a badge is only relevant if you can demonstrate that it actually does what it says on the tin, like a qualification. So I think the assessment around badging is really important, and making sure that they are robust and rigorous and they do deliver the skills that the learner says they have.
Just to clarify, by badges, do you mean the kind of digital visual representation of a certain skill set, so
yeah,
often tied into the gamification?
Yes. Where
they're
very clear about certain skill sets, which is fantastic when you've got a new code or a new language or something that's going through, but not so good for maths, English, science.
But they
just
could
very quickly
be.
Just to bring a quick example into it. So there's a great organization we were working with that was effectively trying to replicate what LinkedIn have done, but for younger people using badges. And last year they were acquired by a large city assessment organization. I'm sure you can guess which. And it is increasing. It is in terms of its role, in terms of how young people maybe view it. I mean, traditionally we do have badges. You've gone to a university, you have effectively that badge from the university. So it's a different maybe interface for the user being the young person striving to get that badge. But it's absolutely of an interest, and it is being used and explored.
I agree with that, and I love the fact that it's getting away from what we've traditionally thought of as, oh, you've got 5 GCSEs and A-level and a degree and whatever. You know, I think it's really lovely to have something that's trying to break out of that. And I think perhaps one way forward, and I know there's work in this area being done, is where you've got badges that are verified through learning analytics data. So you can actually have an audit trail to say, I've got that, and here's how I can show you. That, I think you really start to get somewhere, and then I think you can use it for subjects like maths and what, you know, there's kind of standard subjects, because you can demonstrate over time how somebody's progressed and how they've got to have that badge.
And I think it's interesting just to open a little bit the discussion. It's definitely interesting for students. I can see the potential, but also for teachers in many ways. And you have, you know, kind of certified badges if you become, for instance, a Google certified trainer. But I think increasingly you can see a number of micro-credentials which are really valuable, are not always sanctioned by kind of formal training, but really add a lot of value to the teaching experience. So I would also advocate for that part of the puzzle.
It could also be really helpful from an employer perspective as well. If you have digital badges or badges that actually employers know this is a vital skill for what I'm employing this young person for, I'm not the expert, therefore I need someone who does these things, but I don't necessarily know how to evaluate them myself. If there's kind of an employer base that you can actually see what are these skills, what are the kinds of questions to test them on at the point of interview as well. So they say they've got a particular kind of badge or skill, you can look and ask them the questions with the kind of, you know, this is what this person would evidence if they are at this level. It's kind of helpful for employers in choosing the right people to have in their teams too.
It relates to the earlier point when we were talking about young children and self-regulation. The whole sphere of what I would lump, though it doesn't quite accurately work, into this sort of metacognitive, being aware of your own learning, being aware of your own needs, knowing how to get the help you need, knowing what you do know and what you don't know, and what you can take on and what you can't take on. These are the valuable skills that will help us through lifelong learning. So it's absolutely critical. And that's where I think technology has a very neat role to play, because it can kind of play back what you've done. And then you can share it with, you know, a teacher or your parent or a more able peer, and you can talk round, oh, well, I did this and that didn't work very well, but actually this did. And so it can really help you to understand more about your own learning, because that's what you're going to have to be able to do. And there is a huge amount of evidence, by the way, to demonstrate, just in case you were wondering, the value of those skills.
Chris Smith from Essex Education Services, whose final comment was met with resounding support around the idea that perhaps most efficacy studies and trials could be manipulated in some way, actually getting in the classroom and seeing the outcome of those positive impacts cannot be manipulated in such a way, and perhaps is the final test of how well things are working.
Comment?
Yeah, I think we just all agree.
Yeah, definitely.
Thank you very much, all of you, for giving your time and coming this afternoon and questions. But would you put your hands together for specialists? I've learned a mass out of this. I didn't realise how much I didn't know anything about it. So it was really great to do. But your last question really summarised everything that I was running through my head, is the need to get parents and teachers and everyone involved in the system, so that the feedback comes in and we get it better. But don't give up on your politicians. Anyway, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Next week, another debate on textbooks versus technology, recorded at the Barbican in London. Please share the podcast with anyone you think would enjoy, and don't forget to get in touch at theedtechpodcast@gmail.com.